May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, James Floyd. The commissioner in this case, the lower court,
well, before we get into anything else,
yes,
why are we entertaining an appeal from a commissioner? Why is this not an appeal from Superior Court?
Well, the decision was made in Superior Court, and it impacted his trial.
What judge's ruling are you appealing?
Commissioner Vavilis.
Well,
under Rule 62, what it appears happened was they were given 10 days to, at that particular point, make an appeal to Judge Gabelein. I don't know why that was not done, but it was not. So my understanding...
So is that a waiver?
Excuse me?
Is that a waiver then?
I don't believe so when you're dealing with someone's due process rights.
In Johnson v. State, we held that you can't appeal from a commissioner if you don't have intermediate review by a superior court. So, that didn't happen here.
Correct.
So if it didn't happen here, how does it get to us?
Well, I think what happens as well is that a week before trial, Mr. Goff informed the court again of his concerns about the competency of his client. And the day of trial, Judge Silverman also had the opportunity to observe Mr. Floyd and made determinations, apparently did not determine him to be incompetent.
But where's, as the Chief Justice and Justice Ridgely said, where is something in the record that we're reviewing that a superior court judge ruled with regard to competency?
It would be, and actually I reviewed the transcripts today, and I unfortunately do not believe it was actually placed in the appendix, but there is a decision by Judge Silverman. He was putting it on the record, on the transcript, where he stated he was putting it on the record that he observed the defendant who did testify to a delusional alibi, and he said that he found him to testify lucidly and to seem to know what he was doing in the courtroom.
That's during the trial?
That's correct. Near the end of trial when he was issuing his verdict.
All right, so there's no pretrial ruling by a superior court judge one way or another on the defendant's competency to stand trial.
That's correct.
Are you familiar with Johnson? How do we distinguish that?
Well, I think the way it's distinguished is, first of all, it was adopted by the Superior Court when it's not appealed. My understanding is that it is then entered as to a judgment. And secondly...
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, if the commissioner's decision isn't appealed to a judge, then it is a decision that's on the record.
Right. And what we've held is if you don't appeal the commissioner's decision to a judge, we're not going to review it. We can't review it.
Okay.
So as I understand this record, the commissioner's ruling said you have 10 days to appeal to Judge Gabelein, but you could have appealed to anybody.
Right.
And there was no appeal. How do we get around our holding in Johnson that if you don't appeal a commissioner's ruling, you cannot appeal to this court?
Well, I would argue then that it is the ruling of Judge Silverman. When he was told, and I can certainly, and I will certainly send the court a copy of that transcript. I don't know why I didn't end up putting it in the appendix, but Judge Silverman did state on the record as he was doing reading the verdict, when Mr. Goff raised it to Judge Silverman again, saying, I had decided because of, he was getting nowhere with his client.
But the difficulty with that is that the case has been briefed based on an error attributed to Commissioner Vavilov. And now you want to move at oral argument and tell us why a ruling that you haven't presented to us by Judge Silverman was erroneous when that's never been briefed.
I understand the court's concern with that, but what my point is that the commissioner made a ruling, the Judge Silverman had that before him, and it would be, even if he had not said anything at the trial court, my understanding would be that he's implicitly adopting that ruling, and therefore he went to trial based on those findings of the commissioner. And Judge Silverman also, at that particular time, did make a ruling.
That's a very slippery slope, isn't it? Because from that would flow a rule of law that if an officer, let's say a commissioner of Superior Court, a master in the Court of Chancery, had ruled on a matter, and no one had challenged it, and Superior Court or Chancery goes forward in the case after the time for challenge it has expired, no one renews the challenge in any form, that the Superior Court has adopted the earlier ruling when actually the Superior Court's never been asked to adopt it or reject it.
Well, in this particular case, it's a little different than that. And the record does contain Mr. Goff telling the court a week before trial that he was still concerned about his client's competency. The competency determination by Commissioner Vavila was done 6 months prior to the actual trial date. So arguably, which was part of my concern with the commissioner's report, was that it wasn't concurrent with the trial.
And the difficulty, you have a concern with the commissioner's report. We have a concern with what we're reviewing on appeal.
Correct.
In Johnson v. State, we said specifically, we need to know what the Superior Court had to say about the commissioner's ruling.
Right.
And why it was either adopted, not adopted, so then we can look at that on appeal.
Right.
But in the absence of a Superior Court serving as the intermediate review of the commissioner, you can't come directly to this court, because what we're reviewing is the Superior Court's ruling based on what the commissioner did, not what the commissioner did.
Well, again, what I would state is that Judge Silverman had that before him on the day of trial when Mr. Goff again and told the court he was concerned about his client's competency.
Yeah, but you may be missing Justice Holland's point. That may well be true, but it's not before us in the record. It's not argued in the brief what it was or the significance of it. The other side's not on notice that that's going to be presented to us today for oral argument. So where does that leave us?
Well, I think it was the other side was put on notice of the fact that Mr. Goff repeatedly, the week before trial, and then subsequently, and they had the transcript available to them with respect to the verdict.
On notice for the purpose of this oral argument, so they could respond to that very argument. Were they? It's not in the brief. It's not in the record.
What they were put on notice of was that Mr. Goff repeatedly made applications to a trial judge. A week before trial, and at the sentencing, that at least that is put in the record. Now, with respect,
where in your brief do you assert that a Superior Court judge made an erroneous determination about his competence?
I don't. It's not in there that directly. My argument.
Well, that's all we can review. We can only review an erroneous determination by a Superior Court judge.
Well, I would argue that even though there's not a specific decision signed off by the judge made a decision based on the commissioner's report that he was not going to have another competency hearing. No, I did not raise that in the brief, that the decision of him saying, you know, I'm finding competent, we're not going to have another hearing. No. My argument is essentially that by the fact that Mr. Goff continued to raise the issue to trial judges and they did not choose to act on that, then that was the concern before the court.
But we don't have the transcript citation or anything as to what is the actual order or lack of order that was requested and not rendered by the judge. Is that right?
A portion of it. There is in the appendix Mr. Goff's concern explained the week before trial, where essentially he tells the court that he's not going to, that he still had the inability to work with his client, and that's at A130.
Well, the reason there is a set procedure for taking exception to or appealing from the ruling of a judicial officer at the level of a commissioner or a master. Is so the issue can be teed up for the Superior Court or the Court of Chancery, teeing it up, arguing it, briefing it, whatever that judicial officer wishes, then results in a finding of fact and a conclusion of law which we can review. I don't know anywhere in the rules where it provides that attorneys, rather than following the procedure for teeing it up for additional review, can simply express concerns. in the world, the touchy-feely world in which we live today, maybe that will happen one day. But for some of us, there still is a disciplined procedure. And feelings and concerns don't yet come to the level of following up and doing the necessary steps to tee it up at the next level. That's my problem.
Right, and I understand that. And I guess what I'm trying to get at, and I, you know, obviously the court is going to rule the way the court's going to rule, but if Mr. Goff continually expressed to the court for, I think it went on to 3 years, about his concerns, and Mr. Byard before him, of Mr. Floyd's competency, there came a point where Mr. Goff was being ignored, and he had to go forward with his client was going to continue to be held.
We can accept, I think, I can accept, let's say, the proposition that the commissioner rules one way on Monday and that there is some factual change between that Monday and the 2 months, 3 months, or 6 months later when defense counsel actually has to present his client for trial.
Right.
But then there has to be an application challenging competency or raising the issue of competency and putting it straightforwardly before the trial judge,
right,
so the trial judge can make findings of fact, apply the correct law, and we can review to see whether the findings are supported by the record and whether the law that the trial judge applied was correct or not.
Right.
But we're not there today.
Right.
That's the problem.
I understand that. And the issue, however, is one of Mr. Floyd's due process rights, and that's why I think that at this particular time the issue was raised to this court was that was, you know, that was water under the dam, and at this point, this is what I have before the court, and I have a client whose due process rights may have been violated in this case.
But his due process right included the right to appeal from the commissioner's determination to the superior court.
Right.
And he didn't exercise that due process right.
Right, at that particular time. And he subsequently, and as Justice Steele pointed out, there is the fact, one of the main concerns about the report, and I'm not going to argue the report before the court, but one of the concerns was that it was not concurrently done. So even if this court were to find, address the report and find that it addressed his competency, there was still this ongoing concern by Mr. Goff. He did not, for whatever reason, appeal that particular issue, that report by the commissioner. However,
are you suggesting that we review it for plain error? I mean, we've all read the report, and it's clear that, Mr. Bailey didn't want to be examined again. He wasn't particularly cooperative, and we read your argument about the determination of competency being based on stale or outdated information.
Right.
And all of the merits, we understand. But what we need is some help in getting to the merits. And it appears that we're not there yet, because you can't point to a specific subsequent ruling by a Superior Court judge that was an error that's been preserved on appeal.
Right. I understand what the court's saying. And that's why I'm asking the court to take into consideration this individual's due process rights. He did not avail himself of one particular mechanism in the process, but we have a man who was delusional, would not cooperate with his attorney. His attorney had to make professional judgments without the assistance of his client.
Lack of cooperation is not unique for defendants in criminal cases, but are you arguing that there was something that happened during the trial itself that required the presiding judge to sua sponte grant a mistrial because the defendant was incompetent?
No. I'm saying that Mr. Goff actually mentioned to the court, and I do apologize, it was not in the appendix, and I, if the court would like to, I can submit the transcripts from that. Mr. Goff mentioned, when the verdict was being read, that his client continued to not assist him. The court did find that he was lucid when he testified, although he testified to a delusion. And Mr. Goff said there was the prior incident, which is in the record, where he did tell the court again of his client's competency issues. And he mentioned it again at sentencing, which, of course, comes after the fact, and the trial court did not have that particular information before him. But again, I think that when the court is dealing with someone's due process rights, I understand this court has said it in Johnson, from what Justice Holland has told me. But what I think is most underlying to this, it's not just uncooperative. He would not talk to his attorney. Anytime they would try to have a discussion, he would not talk to him at all. And so that goes beyond the just being uncooperative. So I would ask the court to look at the individual's rights, apply plain error if it feels that is appropriate, and still find that in this case his due process rights were clearly violated. The court indicates that it is aware of the merits and the staleness of the issues of what was relied upon at the hearing. So I'd ask the court to take that into consideration and apply the plain error standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely.
Mr. Williams, we're surprised you didn't cite Johnson.
Well, I probably should have. I read the Mark Franklin case, and I thought that was a little different because it was a family court amenability thing, and I guess I have the same assumption that counsel for Mr. Floyd has, was that when they didn't appeal it, that the trial judge had more or less adopted what the commissioner had said here, although certainly cognizant of the fact that there isn't, or at least I wasn't aware that there was a specific ruling for this court to review. I guess the issue now, since the only claim being asserted on appeal is that Mr. Floyd was not competent to stand trial, is for this court to determine whether that issue has been waived because it was not presented to a superior court judge so that this court would have jurisdiction, or if this court is going to entertain the matter under plain error.
Is that waivable?
Well, I don't know. That's another good question.
Well, the first question is, can you competently waive it? Right?
Well, I don't know if he waived it or his attorney waived it. His attorney certainly competent.
Is there a principle of law known as a delusional waiver?
Well, there may be after this case. This is obviously a strange case. I mean, the man's schizophrenic. There's no doubt about that.
Well, before we get into that, though, do you agree that the commissioner clearly said you have 10 days to take an appeal to Judge Gebline and that no one appealed to Judge Gebline or any other Superior Court judge?
Yes, I think that's correct.
So how do we review Commissioner Vavila's competency determination?
Well, you may not be able to. I think it's akin to the cases that have deemed to be interlocutory and the party attempting to appeal did not follow the interlocutory appeal procedures in Rule 42, that it has to be either dismissed or remanded back to the trial court. As a practical matter, if it's remanded back to the trial court to have a specific ruling by the trial judge, I'm not sure that it's going to be any different than it is now.
You've mixed a couple of different concepts. First, we can't take interlocutory appeals in criminal cases. So it might be interlocutory in the layman's sense. But second, if you have 10 days to ask for it to be reviewed, and you don't ask for it to be reviewed, then you've moved on. That issue's decided.
Well, I think it's waived, yes.
Is there any suggestion here that you're aware of in the record, whether it's part of the appendix before us or not, that more than 10 days after Commissioner Vavila's finding that there was a change in the defendant's circumstances so that it virtually meaningless that there wasn't a challenge taken within 10 days or an appeal taken within 10 days, that the circumstances that would have justified review of what Commissioner Vavila did had changed and there could have been an initial request Superior Court judge to entertain the issue of competency based upon a changed factual circumstance after the 10 days. Anything to suggest that?
I'm not aware of any additional expert medical reports being issued about it.
So the concerns that your colleagues suggest that trial counsel had about Mr. Floyd's competency were based on the same factual support that he had for concerns when it was first raised with Commissioner Vavila.
I think that's true. Now, he may very well not have cooperated with counsel, and that may be an additional factor.
As I understand the record, Mr. Bailey always had this delusion, or characterized it any way you want, about John DuPont.
Correct.
And he had this alibi that, you know, he was elsewhere, which was inconsistent with what appeared to be the facts of the case. But that was consistent throughout. So, as the Chief Justice is saying, is there any record for support that this person made a dramatic change for the worse, and that even if Commissioner Vavila was correct in his competency determination, there had been a change for the worse after that determination that should have prompted or did prompt another inquiry?
I don't think there was. I'm not aware of any.
And in fact, that's what the defendant testified at trial, consistent with this, what's being called a delusion about John DuPont.
Yes, he said he was out walking on Route 41 looking for the DuPont mansion or something. I think that's his alibi. He wasn't there, and Viola Reeves is simply mistaken as to the identity of the person who attacked her.
If I remember correctly, the concern in the record that defense counsel expressed came at the time of the verdict, or were those concerns also expressed before Judge Silverman began the trial?
Well, I don't recall anything in the record. Now, there may have been discussions that were not on the record. I don't know. This was a non-jury trial.
Should we take some extraordinary step in connection with this appeal and allow for an expansion of the appendix or for this issue to be addressed without dismissing the appeal? What's your view of that?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Well, I think probably the cleaner thing, and certainly for purposes of jurisdiction, if it's remanded back to the trial judge to let him make a determination on the basis of the commissioner's report. Now, whether that's going to prompt more examinations of this individual, I don't know, but that's something that's probably best left to the trial judge. At least then it's in the proper posture. We'll have a decision by a superior court judge that can be reviewed. I don't know that anything else will particularly change, but that would hopefully solve the jurisdictional issue.
Do you agree with your opponent that there was nothing at trial that would have required sua sponte action by the trial judge to revisit the issue of competency?
I don't recall anything, no. I mean, his story is what it is. It's not the first time that a defendant's gone to trial in the face of eyewitness testimony and just simply claim that everybody's mistaken. That wasn't me. It must have been somebody else. You know, that was his defense, that he wasn't there and she must be wrong in accusing me and selecting me out of the police lineup the day after all this happened. I can proceed on with the rest of the argument, or if the court wants to remand the matter.
The only reason I raised the question I did was, is it your view, based on Johnson or any other case, that this appeal should simply be dismissed, or does the state believe there's another alternative to teeing this issue up before us?
Well, I think there's another alternative, and since that's the only issue that's being raised here, it probably would be better to remand it back to the trial judge in fairness to the accused here, and let the trial judge make a definitive ruling. He may very well adopt the commissioner's report. It's a fairly lengthy order, about 23 pages. But he's also had the opportunity to personally observe Mr. Floyd during his trial testimony as well, during the bench trial. That's probably the fairer and more just thing to do here rather than simply dismissing it outright. If you do that, then Mr. Floyd's going to be totally precluded from having any appellate review at this stage.
Well, he could bring a Rule 61.
Yeah. Well, that's when you confront all the procedural bars, and I-3 would probably be applicable, that you didn't raise anything else.
I could follow what you were recommending until you said the judge did the trial, because then we really would have a convoluted record on appeal if the judge decided that Commissioner Vavila made a correct competency determination based upon the trial judge's observations of the defendant's demeanor and testimony at trial. Wouldn't that be a fairly confusing record?
Well, it'd certainly be a more expanded record. And normally the trial judge is simply going to get the report and go through it. And he may very well look at the same evidence that the commissioner did, make independent assessments. Here you just have an additional factor that the trial judge has also had the opportunity to personally view them. I don't know that it's any lesser quantum of proof. It probably is a little more than you would normally have. So I don't know that that's anything that's detrimental to Mr. Floyd. It's a quagmire, and I'm not sure what's the easiest solution. I think perhaps remanding it back to the trial judge, give him the opportunity to independently review the commissioner's findings, make his own findings and determinations, and then the matter can be sent back to the court on an expedited basis.
Now, as I understand it, Mr. Floyd's position was always that he was competent.
Yes, he insisted on his right to speedy trial. His complaint was that he had already been held for 2 years, and he just wanted to have this matter resolved one way or the other. And all he really asked was that he wanted to be treated like everyone else.
Although, you know, you initially talked about the complications with Rule 61, the one thing that would happen in a Rule 61 proceeding is you get some insight into what happened after Commissioner Vavila's ruling. And when he ruled that Floyd was competent, it could be that there was a decision made not to appeal from that because it was consistent with what the defendant wanted to do, and defense counsel could have simply said, okay, you've contended you're competent. Now the commissioner's agreed. We're not going to challenge it over your objection, and you'll get to have the trial you want.
Well, that may very well have been, and that's certainly what opportunity would be presented in a Rule 61 context. It's just the way these things work is that the mountain gets steeper and steeper each step, and then after you've either bypassed or exhausted your direct appeal, when you go into post-conviction relief, there are procedural bars that the court's obligated to consider first.
The insight that's clearly apparent to me in Justice Holland's last observation would certainly explain why defense counsel simply continued to express concern rather than re-raise the competency issue in some formal way and ask the Superior Court to address it, even after the appeal time. He may have been compromising his own concerns with the desire of his client in a way that he thought was the best way to handle it.
Well, that may be, and here I think, you know, we have one of these classic cases where there's a collision between what defense counsel thinks is the best approach and what the defendant himself thinks. And I guess if the appeal is simply dismissed for lack of jurisdiction, these issues could be raised in a Rule 61 proceeding.
What do we make of this language? This is in the sentencing order of Judge Silverman under the notes section. Defendant is dangerously mentally ill. He is a serious threat to himself and others. Defendant must be supervised for the rest of his life, if ambulatory, to ensure that he stays in treatment. Does that suggest anything that he should have been handled differently other than sent to prison?
Well, if he's going to be sent to prison, he certainly needs his medication. He did seem to be making progress at the Delaware Psychiatric Center when he was taking his medication. The very first assessment by Dr. Much, I think it was about 2 months after this crime had occurred in January of 2003. And at that point, he determined that psychologist, I believe he is, determined that he was not competent. And that was the initial finding in the Superior Court. Later on, when Dr. Foster, who's a forensic psychiatrist on staff at the center, when she evaluated him, she said, well, he had been making progress. He was taking his medication. She pointed out is interaction during various groups. I guess there's some group therapy that's being conducted there. And he was not as withdrawn. He was talking and acting appropriately, interacting with staff and interacting with other patients. So,
my inquiry is this. Why wouldn't he be guilty but mentally ill and sentenced accordingly to go to the Delaware Psychiatric Center?
Well, I think because it was determined that he was competent to stand trial and they were not asserting that defense. I mean, that's what I guess defense counsel and Dr. Mechanic thought should be the defense or one of the possibilities for the defense. It could be either insanity or guilty but mentally ill. The difficulty with Mr. Floyd was voicing, I think, was that he didn't want to be sent to the Delaware Hospital for the rest of his life if he was not going to recover. Normally, John Nash notwithstanding, I guess schizophrenics do not recover. It's just simply a long-term condition, and that's it. There are treatment modalities.
Well, wouldn't it, so that I'm clear on this, or maybe I'm unclear on this, if he was convicted as opposed to, because he was competent to stand trial, and yet the judge found that he was dangerously mentally ill or guilty but mentally ill, he would serve his sentence at the Delaware Psychiatric Center, wouldn't he?
Yes, he would.
But instead, he's been sentenced to the Delaware Correctional Center.
Yes. Because he was determined to be competent to stand trial.
So this case stands in sharp contrast to Cook, where the defendants and the defense counsel disagreed about how to go forward. This seems to be another indication that defense counsel didn't raise a guilty but mentally ill issue. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so. That seemed to be the strategy, or one of the alternative strategies anyway. It was insanity or guilty but mentally ill. And I think Dr. Mechanic may have testified in the Cook case recently too. So these are very problematic issues. They're very hard for the defense counsel. What can you do when your client insists upon one strategy that seems to make no sense? You bring in your own expert. And here it gets even more complex because we have a differing opinion among two psychiatrists, the one psychiatrist who seemingly built some rapport with Mr. Floyd and was able to do an evaluation, at least to her satisfaction, concluded that after being at the hospital for over a year that he was now competent to stand trial. Dr. Mechanic, who was not able to complete his evaluation because Mr. Floyd simply wouldn't cooperate with him, he drew the conclusion based on Mr. Floyd's medical records and seeing Mr. Floyd testify at the competency hearing that he did not think he was competent to stand trial, although Dr. Mechanic conceded that was the first time he had ever offered an opinion on that kind of basis, that normally he does a normal evaluation of a cooperating individual and then is able to make an assessment. So he was handicapped, too, in what he could do or say.
We have another alternative, which is to dismiss the appeal and return the matter to the Superior Court with instructions to appoint counsel, contract counsel for Mr. Floyd, to review with him any further remedies.
Yes, I think that could be done, and he would certainly be within his one-year time period for post-conviction relief if they wanted to do that. Exactly what to do, I'm not sure, and the state has certainly made arguments about expanding the encompassment of plain error to the point where virtually everything seems to be plain error, and I realize there's difficulties with that, but at the same time, The record isn't what it should be here. I'm not really confident the court has jurisdiction to rule on this, but at the same time, it does seem unfair to have Mr. Floyd foreclosed because a decision of some sort was made not to appeal the commissioner's ruling in a timely fashion. Admittedly, it was a short period of time, 10 days, but counsel was on notice and needed to do something within that time period.
Well, it would be unfair unless he and his counsel discussed it and decided not to do it.
Well, that may be, and that may be the answer to the whole thing. We just don't know that at this point.
Okay.
If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those. Thank you.
first of all, I appreciate the prosecutor's recognition of my client's rights and that the fairness is the issue here. I'd like to point out one thing. The problem was not necessarily like Cook in that the defendant wanted to do one thing and his attorney wanted to do another. In the Cook case, they consulted with him and he doesn't like that particular defense. In this case, they never were able to even get that far. And at the trial, Mr. Goff's defense was hamstrung because he was not able to get any information from the defendant to help him either elaborate on a defense or go for mentally ill defense.
Well, let's step back one step back to Justice Holland's continued expression of concern. What neither you nor the record shows is whether or not Mr. Floyd, who now through you claims that his rights have been violated, actually sat down and agreed with Mr. Goff or whomever was representing him at the time that it wasn't his desire to challenge Commissioner Vavila's determination that he was competent because he'd been in jail for 2 years or in the hospital for 2 years. He wanted his trial. He wanted a speedy trial. But we just don't know the answer to that, do we?
No, we don't. It's not in the records. I wouldn't have been able to obtain it from the record. However, by the expression of Mr. Goff's concerns before the hearing, at the hearing, and before trial and after trial, he could not have any discussions with Mr. Floyd. So I don't know who made the specific decision. And as noted, even if the attorney agreed that he was competent within those 10 days, his competency can change over time. So when he raised the issue again prior to trial and at sentencing, again, he was raising the issues.
All right. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.